I'm Alex Hirsch, the voice of Bill Cipher.
Hey, I'm Mike Aranda. I was the creative director.
I'm Matt Chapman, and I think I helped write this one.
Yeah, you did.
So, Dreamscapers. This was definitely one of the hardest episodes that we made season one. I think it's also one of the most beloved episodes from season one, so the effort, I think, really paid off.
Yeah, I thought this one turned out good.
Our sort of mission for this was we wanted to set up the season finale, and we also wanted to introduce Bill Cipher, which was a character that we had always kind of known we wanted to put in the show, but we couldn't entirely figure out how we were going to do it.
Yeah.
And we didn't know early on whether he was necessarily a full villain, whether he was more like Q in Star Trek and he's just screwing with you.
Yeah.
And just trying to solve those questions, and in addition to trying to figure out the logic of what Gideon wants from Stan and how he intends to get it, and the potential of a dream episode is part of what made this so difficult. Because when we thought, we're doing a dream episode, it was like, well, let's go in Seuss's dreams and Mabel's dreams and Wendy's dreams. And the first drafts, we started with drafts of that. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. There were dreams. Yeah, they were all hooked up together, remember? Like, they had to lay on the floor in, like, a star shape. And, they were all going in through each other's brains.
And
And then I think, like, Bill, like, chased them. It was kind of like the end of Being John Malkovich. Like, Bill was, like, chasing them through everybody's dreams.
Yeah, and Seuss's dream was, like, him in a children's book, and it's like, you know, you found the apple. A is for apple. He's like, I love apples. This place is great.
Yeah, we were having so much fun with the idea that, like, Seuss's dream world was basically, like, Winnie the Pooh or Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, there's, like, a narrator.
Just this sort of, like, Seuss went to the shop.
Oh, dude, I love this voice. It tells me what to do. Apparently there's a clue I should be hunting for. There's a little blue dog over here.
I feel like that turned into the, like, creepy British bulldog. That was what that finally morphed into. It was like, well, what if he, like, watched, like, a Simon in the Land of Chalk Drawing show when he was a kid, and it totally disturbed him. So there's, like, a British bulldog that he's, like, has nightmares about.
So, like, that was, sometimes you have an episode where it's a very, you know, very sort of small, simple story that you're trying to milk for content, and other times you have an episode like this where there is so much potential in a dream episode that, you know, when you get your first draft, it is, like, a million pages long, and you have this heartbreaking decision of what do we cut.
Yep.
And what do we focus on? And what is the core of this episode? What's the heart of it? You know, we the idea of Mabel's dreams, my goodness, we had this idea that she's dreaming of this crazy high school with these rad boys. And, you know, a lot of that ended up in Mabeland that was originally written for this. But I think we ultimately focused on the idea of, like, we need to establish Gideon's motive. And we think that we hadn't really done a Dipper-centered story in a while.
Yeah.
And we felt like this was an interesting way to focus on Dipper and Stan's relationship.
Yeah, because, like, ultimately it felt like the concept of Stan trying to toughen Dipper up because he actually loved him, and, you know, he got that from his dad when he was growing up, actually ended up being the most emotionally resonant of the ideas. And even though the other ones, like Seuss, his British narrator, was so delightful, but, like, ultimately it didn't have the same amount of story meat, so that one kind of fell by the wayside, and we turned up the volume on the Dipper Stan one that ultimately, like, we cared more about at the end of the day.
Yeah, if we could have the turn at the end of the episode result in characters loving each other more than you thought, that always was a winner.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't sure, because, like, the second episode of the series is Grumpy Old Stan's Actually Got a Heart of Gold, and I wasn't sure how many episodes can we do.
Yeah.
Stan's a jerk, then he's got a heart of gold. Stan's a jerk, then he's got a heart of gold. Turns out there's no ceiling on that. It is always... Modern Family has done 800 episodes of Ed O'Neill actually being a sweetheart. Never fails to make you smile.
Well, but I feel like the way we get away with this in this one is that you find out more about Stan's character than you knew than the beginning of the episode. You find out, oh, this is what Stan's childhood was like, and it gives you insight into how he
got that way.
Yeah, and how he chooses to deal with Dipper, whereas in the first episode, the Gobblewonker episode, you don't get that much insight. You just see, oh, he's a sad old man that wishes his kids liked him more.
This scene right here, probably one of the most kind of controversial scenes within the process of making this episode, not so much because we had an issue with the executives, actually, but because just in terms of our creative team, we originally had a very different intro to Bill. Originally, it was Bill enters Dipper in his dreams, challenges him, says, I'm going to go into your uncle's mind, try and catch me. And it was a really funny scene.
Yeah, it was great.
It had some great gags. It was boarded by Matt Brawley, who did a wonderful job. And when that scene was, I think, pitched out, it got a big laugh. And then when we watched the episode in the editorial, we realized, oh my God, this episode makes no sense.
Yeah.
The episode was really long. It was really confusing.
It's super confusing.
And Bill was a character who had been summoned off camera by Gideon. We didn't know why. We didn't know what their relationship was.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And me and Mike at the 11th hour wrote this scene of Gideon conjuring Bill, Bill saying, I know lots of things, deer teeth. The reality's illusion, the universe of hologram, buy gold, buy. All of that was the last thing added to this episode.
Yeah.
And I remember there was some friction within the team because the previous opening was really good.
Yeah.
On its own. And you know, I really have to thank Mike for kind of because I remember coming to you and being like, "Am I crazy, Mike?
Yeah.
Like, do we need to adjust this?" And I remember you being like, "The episode is more important than the scene."
Yeah.
And like giving me the kind of push to be like, all right, it's frustrating, but we need to redo this one. And it really paid off.
Yeah.
This is one of the most quoted, remembered, loved scenes in the history of Gravity Falls. And I'm so grateful that we pushed through, even though it was tough.
Yeah, well,
I remember coming in the next morning, like, I had stayed as late as I could as a father of two with you guys in, like, the edit room, and you were, like, I was still kind of determining what to do, and the next morning I came in, and it was just like, Chapman, deer teeth, you got to get in the edit room, you got to see what we did, and it was like, and when I came in, I was like, what, deer teeth, what? And then you showed me that scene, and I just remember, like, yeah, deer teeth was like, I was like, this is a new high, like, and I had always been, like, super proud to be a part of the show, and was like, no matter what happened with the show when it airs, like, I am like super psyched to have been a part of this. And then when deer teeth happened, I was just like, this is like, now I'm like, I'm gonna wear deer teeth as a badge for the rest of my life. I wrote on this episode. I can't claim any credit for deer teeth, but I was a part of an episode.
That was on a list of like 25 alts that I wrote, and Joe Pitt read it and he was so deeply disturbed. He's like, what is wrong? I think like Mike has a serious like mental problem. But then he put it in the episode and it turned out great.
Yeah,
or, turned out great. What does that mean?
I mean, I loved it. That was, yeah, no, in that scene, deer teeth is Mike's, Bill's weird screaming of the gold, that's mine. Like,
yeah.
That's sort of things that are kind of more horrifying and graphic you can count on Mike for. The joke with Bill Cipher for me was always, the concept with him originally was, there's a sort of trope in fiction of this sort of godlike character who messes with the protagonist. Like, you know, in Star Trek, it's Q. I think in the comic Bone, you've got the dragon and Ted the Bug. Like, I like this idea of a character who kind of knows the end of the story and pops in and kind of messes with you. And for me, the joke of like, oh, let's take the triangle, the Eye of Providence on the back of the $1 bill. You know, I was into like, you know, National Treasure and stuff. Let's take the Eye of Providence. Let's slap a Mr. Peanut top hat on him. And let's give him this kind of David Lynch, Gordon Cole from Twin Peaks yelling voice. It was super funny to me. I remember pitching it to one of our artists, Sean Jimenez, early on. And he's like, you got to get that in the show somehow. Nobody understood what it was until they saw it.
Yeah.
This
Didn't
line
you actually try and get David Lynch to do the voice, too?
We did. We reached out to David Lynch, and he turned us down. And I'm actually grateful that he did, because even though he would have done a wonderful job, Bill became such an important character that to have to try to work with his schedule and get him in all the time, I'm actually grateful that it was like, oh, okay, Bill's a main character now. I can hop in the booth and do him anytime. Got to give a shout out to Ian Worrell, our art director. This episode won an Emmy for art direction.
This stuff is amazing.
For good reason. The artists on the show are so good, and they're used to kind of being forced to have a kind of realism, and we said, go, let loose.
Yeah.
Go nuts. Make it this black and white Escher nightmare world, and they blew us away.
Totally.
Some Easter eggs in there. They walk past a swing set where one swing is broken and one swing is repaired. That's a metaphor for Stan and his brother. We knew at this point that that's where we were headed. Mm-hmm. We see that same swing set in Tale of Two Stans when we see their summer. It was a tricky thing with this episode, knowing that Stan has a brother and a lot of his memories would be about that. The kids can't see that, so we just have to sort of hint to it. Mike, do you remember there was a big change we made here. Do you remember it? About the Well of Secrets and the code.
Yeah, the Well of Secrets, you had to swim in the well, right?
Yeah, it had this serpentine logic where it's like, you go in the mystery house, and then once there, you go through the mystery door 4, then you go into the mystery well, then once there, you get the mystery key, and it was, like, so complicated.
Yeah, they had to find Stan's subconscious to get to the Well of Secrets, to find the jar containing the scroll with the memory, and this was another late edition where we were like, we need to cut 5 minutes out of this episode. Okay, it's a door.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of doors. One door is the memory door. Kraz and Zyler, these characters were conceived, invented, and I pretty much think every line of dialogue of those was written by Matt.
Yeah. Matt definitely named them.
I feel like that was another one where there's a lot of lists of alts of what their names could be, but they're all like misuses of X's and Z's.
Yeah, what was your inspiration coming up with the names for these guys?
I don't know, man. You just like start picturing all of the t-shirts that kids wore in the 80s to school. Like I grew up in Georgia, but for some reason everyone wore like surf wear, like Gotcha Gear and Catch It, and it was all like these were the dudes that were on their shirts, and they had like weird laser grids behind them and swirly like curly cues, and,
yeah,
and they were like named like Kraz and Zyler's Crab Shack on the Malibu Coast.
The way that Kraz and Zyler talk, where they're like, they have the intelligence level of like a golden retriever or a fruit roll-up that came to life. Like that, I remember those were some of the jokes in Matt's draft of the script that made it like all the way to the end. Like I didn't want to touch those because it was such a funny, like, their thought process.
Yeah.
Do you remember that there was one where, and it might have been the one where they eventually say, Mabel's saying something right now or whatever, where one of them eventually said, like, are you thinking about the Olympics? And the other one was, I totally am. And then we found out you can't say the Olympics.
That is a heartbreaker, because that's, I've thought about, are you thinking about the Olympics, like, since this was on the air.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to use proper nouns in the series, so we couldn't say Super Bowl, we had to say Football Bowl, and a line like, are you thinking about the Olympics? I am! Like, without the word Olympics, it was nonsense. Like, it was already nonsense. Like, these guys sort of remind you of an old t-shirt of a logo.
Yeah.
Like, but without being able to reference it, it was, like, a bridge too far. And that was often the most heartbreaking thing, was getting a joke that we all busted up at, and then I get the note, and I can't think of a way to save it. Yeah. I'm always trying.
Well, and it's hard to be funny anyway, and then you're in these like really tight confines of like kids' TV where you can't use proper nouns and you can't, you know, swear or reference politics or religion or anything. So you're trying to be funny in that context, and when you get a win, you're so happy, and then it gets taken away from you. You're like, what? You can't say Olympics.
So this scene was boarded by the co-director of this episode, Joe Pitt. Did a phenomenal job. You know, we liked giving him the emotional scenes. Because the acting was really important. this was just us trolling our fans hard. We didn't know if we would have fans. We had them a little bit, but we just didn't know what the level was. And we knew that in the next episode we were going to reveal that.
Yeah.
So we thought, let's remind them of it, and let's also kind of make it seem like we're never going to get around to it.
Yeah.
So when it does arrive, it's even more satisfying.
Because there was, at this point in the show, it was kind of like we hadn't mentioned that mystery stuff in a long time, and I think people were getting like upset. Or at least even us as sort of, you know, people that, fans of the show ourselves, were like, when are we going to get back to this mystery stuff? Because there were a lot of one-offs.
Kraz and Zyler, also designed, I think, originally by Phil Rinda, who was a designer on our first season, for Mabel's fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think that was also part of it, was they're a holdover from the idea that we were going to do a Mabel dream.
Yeah.
And we so loved the idea that she got to see her dream boys again. And then when we cut that whole thread, it was like, we need the boys in there.
Yeah.
So, like, I can't remember the current line that sets it up where Mabel's like, he's like, I can read your mind. Mabel's like, you can't tell what I'm thinking. Oh, yeah, you're thinking about these boys. It's just a super convoluted way for us to have the boys in the episode.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any logical sense why they're there, but it's funny, therefore we kept it. Mabel.
Oh, yeah, this is my favorite. This is some of the most disturbing stuff. I forgot, because we always had this idea, of double Seuss's. Like, that was the thing. It's got to be Seuss is the one that, like, because he's the most innocent, and it would be the most horrifying to have it be Seuss who is inhabited by Bill.
To have his eye morph into this guy. So the challenge here was, I do remember this because there were so many great ideas, we were really excited about the idea of a dream fight.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, a fight with imagination, with these characters. Well, you could do anything. And then I remember there was a panic moment that I had. And I think, Mike, you might have shared a little bit of my panic about, wait a minute, if we're doing a imagination fight, like, that's the biggest thing you can do in an animated world.
Totally.
And how are we ever going to top this for the rest of the series? Like, we were worried that our season finale, Gideon Rises, was going to feel really mundane compared to all this chaos. And we were also worried that, you know, for the remainder of the show, we knew...
we wouldn't be able to top it.
Yeah, like, I always knew that there would be some kind of apocalypse at the end of the series and I had this idea that maybe part of the apocalypse was an imagination fight, that Dipper and Mabel used their imagination to fight whoever the villain was. We didn't know he was Bill, but we knew there was going to be a fight. And we were worried, are we just going to use up our most visual interesting ideas for this, and are people like, are we not going to be able to top that? And I think it was a lesson for me in TV writing that, like, people tend to take each episode at what you set up in each episode. People are like, all right, you've set my expectations this week for this first moment.
Yeah.
And like, okay, last week was the world ended and this week is Mermando. People tend to generally be okay with it more often than I would have been as an audience. I think.
And I also think you learn too, that you like, when you're younger, you're like, oh, I need to save this idea for later. But especially when you're making TV, it's like, hey, man, if you got a good idea now, use it.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of good ideas out there.
Yeah, I remember the execs were worried about, but this and Gideon Rises were being like, you know, so you've got an imagination fight with Bill in somebody's mind, and then you think they're moving away from Gravity Falls at the end of the next episode. It's like, are you sure you can do both of these things and then have a season two with anything like with any higher stakes than that?
Yeah, and it was, you know, I was concerned as well, and in retrospect, I should have been less concerned. You know, I think there's an elastic reality to animation and to television in particular. And you know, we were always trying to strike that balance, and I'm glad we were concerned about it so that we could try to find it. But like, generally we found that, yeah, like Mike said, you got a good idea, use it.
Well, and it forces you to come up with more interesting creative stuff later, because,
and you'll often think of things that are way better than what you were planning on.
Yeah, because it's like, I feel like, you know, I wasn't really so much a part of the show for the second season, but that season finale I love, and I don't think, you know, wouldn't have been what it was if we were trying to hold on to all these old ideas, you know.
Well, and Stan and you know, Not What He Seems, which is maybe my favorite episode of the series, like, you know, we couldn't have gotten there if we didn't have these changes happen at this point. So this I love this sequence. I love Stan's memories. Eagle-eyed viewers will notice that the design of Stan does not look like how he looks in Tale of Two Stans. There's a very sneaky reason for that, which is we had different designers. Season 1 and 2, we had different artists, and the point of this scene was to show that Stan had to sort of grow out of his shell. And then when we were sort of discovering and inventing the tale of him and his brother and exactly how it would work, we realized we need to differentiate their personalities. You know, I could say, oh, it was all a plan. In another scene, Stan would take his glasses on and off, and if there's a chart that we made, but it's just different artists, different designers.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we were like, what services each episode better? You know, Mike, you could tell him, like, I was more than any person on Earth being like, can we please keep things consistent? Like,
yeah,
trying
totally.
To, like, make changes and make adjustments at the last second, but there's only so much you could do, you know? So this was one of those instances where we had to make a call.
Totally. Well, and
I think you got closer than most shows that have the kind of like lore and canon that this show has. I think you got closer than most as far as consistency.
Well, like at this point,
actually,
you know, this
having
is before,
stuff planned out from earlier.
Yeah,
we did have this grand plan of like making J.J. Abrams eat it. It was like, dude, we've got all this stuff figured out, and it's only season one. We're gonna blow everyone's mind.
We are full of youthful arrogance.
This is like before we wrote a single episode.
Yeah, and then we like had to learn Microsoft Word.
You! Ah, my cuteness! What did you do to
my cuteness?
You're next! Cool, we're next! No!
This sequence boarded by David Gemmell, Kras and Zyler burning alive always makes me laugh.
Well, because Gemmell would do these horrific drawings of Mabel and Dipper and put them all over his cube. And then we're like, we should put that in the episode. It's the most grotesque thing in the world.
Yeah, David Gemmell, one of our artists, a master at replicating like kind of replicating classic animation styles, and you would just draw the most disgusting versions of these characters. And we tried to honor that, but there's no way the boards could be as gross. There's no way the animation could be as gross as what he actually drew. His boards are still so much more disgusting than what came out in the animation.
Kitten fists. I'd like to point out personally, Alex pointed out one time, like maybe around like the end of the season, he's like, Mike, every episode you turn in, there's some joke about a half man, half dog. Like, I don't know what your obsession with it is. It just made me laugh super hard, but I finally got it in. Eat it, Alex.
It was Mike's dream to get a dog man in there, and he did. And when people talk about this episode, they're like, it was the dog man episode.
Yeah, they love it. They love it. I can't get enough.
Gotta give credit to Brad Breek for this amazing score. I think it's sort of like this in Brad's mind. He loves synthy pop and always just leapt at the chance to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, all the stuff.
What's the was it called? In the Heat of the Times. I have an early demo in GarageBand of that song, and it's me singing what would be Mabel's lines. And
oh
it's
yeah,
like,
you
in the
did
heat
all those songs.
Of the times, we are all dreams.
We would. Matt's a musical genius, and he would sometimes write music for our episodes, and we 9 out of 10 times would have to like cut all of it except for one word for time, but it was always so good.
I have there's like 10 verses to Straight Blanchin' that I wrote. It's like an epic,
that's
like,
right.
Public Enemy level, like 5 minute long.
So this was another late adjustment where originally they just defeated Bill and stuck him in a vortex, and we were like, no, we need to get the sense that this is a more powerful character than that. So he just says, enough, you know, you're more tough than I thought, I'm gonna peace out. Because we were having so much fun with putting him in this episode, we were like, we need to suggest that he's got power. But at this point, we did not know he was for sure the big bad.
No, totally.
We were still figuring that out. So another logic flaw that drove me crazy that I wanted to find time to fix and then just gave up, and thankfully people forgave us for, was this whole episode is predicated on the idea that if Gideon can physically hold Stan's deed, he owns the shack, which is not how deeds or houses or anything works. It's very Looney Tunes logic. But we needed something simple to hinge the episode on. And I was really worried. I was worried that people were going to watch this and be like, what? He's just holding a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And by and large...
Kids don't know how deeds work.
Well, I mean, but we also have adult fans. And by and large, everyone just sort of... I feel like if you land the emotional beats, if you're entertaining, and if you understand... If characters establish what's important to them, you'll believe it, even if it makes no real-world sense.
Totally. And I also feel like the boarding pays off, too, where it's like, you know, you see the villain standing there holding the deed, and you're like, wow, I guess he won.
Yeah, we cut right to him with this wrecking ball. You're like, oh, shoot, okay, wow. Twist ending.
Oh. And is this the episode? Does this have the wonderful just, like, silent ending? Yeah.
Yeah, this is Ian Worrell just going
so beautiful.
Sick.
This was our first
time. Is that
time.
All Ian Worrell stuff, too?
Yeah, this is all Ian. We, our art director, Ian, he's such a beautiful painter and does such good work. Rarely has time to actually do the paintings all himself, top to bottom. And he just created this in After Effects because I said, we need something spooky. We want to end. We want people to be worried.
Yeah, you can't have like a silly joke of like Krazenzyler in the vortex or whatever at the end of it.
I would do that. I want that.